thank you for being here for another session in the Nussbaum Family Medical Halacha and Ethics Program. And I actually got the Nussbaum there online. It's great to see you. Thank you very much for dedicating our Medical Ethics and Halacha program. I also want to thank the Bayit and Shari Shamayim for co-presenting the series with me, for promoting the series. Yes, this session was supposed to be at the Bayit. Thanks to COVID, that did not work out. God willing, our next session will be with an in-person option. I'm going to be setting up the registration page later today, and there will be an opportunity on it to specify whether you plan to be in person or whether you plan to be on Zoom or whether you are, like many people, unsure. I also want to thank Dr. Barry Pakis for all his help, not only in terms of getting accreditation for the class, but also for his help in getting ready for it, going through the vignettes, challenging on some of the cases. That was very, very helpful for me. Our topic this morning, and I'm going to repost the link for the source sheet in a second. Our topic for this morning is family planning in Judaism. And I want to give a special thanks to Nishmat with their annual Health and Halacha Conference, because when they held it last year, they invited me to speak on that topic alongside Yoetzet Halacha Rivka Sonnenberg. And I learned a lot from that presentation and incorporated it in developing the presentation for this morning. I will note as well that it happens to work out this way on the calendar. They're actually starting this year's conference today. It's running, I think, today and the next couple of days. So you look that up online. I think it's healthandhalacha.com, something along those lines. You should be able to find that. I certainly heartily recommend. The next session in our series is scheduled for Monday, June 20th, 7 p.m. at Shaarei Shamayim in person, as well as, again, with the Zoom option. Note that in the very beginning of the year, we promoted it as being June 13th, but then we had to move the date. So the date is June 20th for that. That will be on use of artificial intelligence in medical decision making. And that should be a lot of fun. One last note about just programs and community. The Rabbi Price Foundation is having the annual Yahrzeit Shir in memory of Rav Avram Price this afternoon. It will be on Zoom. Rav Asher Weiss will be speaking. His topic is Ve'ahavta L'Reacha Kamocha in Halacha and Agada. And the Zoom for it, I'm putting the link in the chat right now for anybody who would like to be able to catch that. It is free of charge, and Rav Asher Weiss does not need my recommendation for him. Definitely worth catching. Okay. Last note, there will be an evaluation form. It is actually linked on the source sheet. I gave you the link for it. On the sheet, Dr. Barry Pakis also emailed it to the people who registered in advance. Please make sure you fill out the evaluation form. It is important for us to maintain accreditation that we have the evaluation. Even if you're not a practicing doctor, medical professional, your input is valuable. Just skip the parts that talk about the impact on your medical practice. Okay, so family planning. On the top of the source sheet, I put the agenda. Jewish law and Jewish society place a powerful emphasis on procreation. It is the first divine commandment recorded in the Bible, and rabbinic literature classified it as a, quote, major commandment. I'll come back to that. Nonetheless, a host of factors may cause a family to decide that they cannot pursue biological procreation. What options does Jewish law offer for people in this situation? What is the role of a medical professional in counseling such families? So there's an awful lot to talk about under the heading of family planning. If you're looking at the source sheet, you see I put links for three previous classes that we've had over the years. One on surgeries which prevent conception. The focus of that class was primarily on endometrial ablation and prostate surgery, but we talked about more issues as well there. A 2017 session on fertility treatments in Judaism, and then a 2018 session on abortion. With all that's been in the news in the last couple of weeks about abortion. I've had a number of people ask if we're going to talk about it in this session, and the answer is we did that already in 2018, and if we start doing that in this session, we will not get to anything else. So please catch the recording. I actually think it wasn't a half bad class, so try that one and send me questions and comments. Okay, so producing children is a matter of great difficulty for many people for many reasons, and certainly within the Jewish community with its own pressures. Some people have trouble finding a mate. Some people face challenges in producing children. Some people have lost children. Rachmana litzlan, they've had issues. We daven for the physical and spiritual healing of all people who are in that situation, and really I hope nothing that we say today will insult, offend, or harm that position. You know, it's very important to remember that even as we talk about the great mitzvah of producing children, the mitzvah is fundamentally to do the best we can. When the Gemara talks about the questions one will be asked in the next world, one of the questions is Asakta, the period of Arivia. It's, did you involve yourself in trying to procreate? It's not, did you succeed? And that's, you know, it's not within human control. So that's something I wanted to stress at the outset. And then the other is a traditional point, which really has to be reiterated each time, which is nothing I say here should be seen as psak. We're discussing halachic issues. We're bringing halachic sources with the goal of giving people material for their thought processes and for their conversations. But the issues are so subjective and so case by case that they really have to be discussed personally with a competent halachic authority. These aren't issues where anything I say can be the answer to a situation. Okay, let's launch into the questions that we're going to be looking at. The first question we have. Leah, a 25-year-old mother of two children, experienced heavy postpartum depression after both births, managing it only with extensive therapy and drug treatment. She would like to begin birth control to avert future pregnancies. Does halacha recognize depression as a risk factor sufficient to warrant avoiding future pregnancies? So this one is going to be a relatively straightforward one. Many of you have already heard discussions of this in previous classes in our series or elsewhere, and the weight that halacha gives to mental illness and to depression is well known. But I think it's important, just in terms of framing things and getting started, that we start with a case in which we know halachic authorities will be inclined to help the family to be able to avoid future pregnancies. The only question is going to be how, but we'll talk about that. But then we're going to move into a second case. Sarah is a family therapist counseling Mr. and Mrs. Goldschwartz for challenges in their relationship. The Goldschwartzes have been married for nearly 6 years. Each of them exhibits signs of great stress, possibly associated with a financial, emotional, and physical strain of raising their three children, one age 4 and twins age 2. Mr. Goldschwartz is 27 years old. Mrs. Goldschwartz is 24. They are Orthodox Jews. Sarah would like to propose a pause, at least, in childbearing. Would it be worthwhile for Sarah to advise the Goldschwartzes to speak to their rabbi? So here, it's not the clear-cut type of postpartum depression. It's something a little more vague, where the therapist sees the strain on the relationship, sees that they're handling an awful lot, three children, age 4 and under. Is there room for saying, let's at least pause childbearing? So those are going to be the opening two cases. I'm actually not going to read out all the vignettes because those two are sort of their own thing, and then we'll move from there into the ensuing question. Actually, no, I'm going to read out number 3. Sorry, number 3 is part of the set. The Goldschwartzes, with their rabbi's halachic prescription, use birth control for 5 years. So now their children are, thank God, 9 and 7. But arriving at the end of 5 years, Mr. and Mrs. Goldschwartz feel that they are happy having a family of 5. Their relationship is in a better place than it was. Their finances are reasonably strong. But they see the tuition bills coming and the way their friends with more children are stressed. And they would like to continue their pause. What might their rabbi say now? So that's the third one. First one, postpartum depression. Second one, a lot of strain on the father and mother and in the relationship itself. And then third, you know, we're actually doing all right where we are. Could we just say, let's continue our pause? So let's frame this. Well, actually, let me just ask questions and comments before we start to address these cases. Okay, then let's go for it. So I want to spend some time explaining the challenge that drives this entire conversation. Traditionally, we identify three sources in Tanakh for the mitzvah of having children. The first one, of course, is Pru Urvu. God says, bear fruit and multiply. He actually says it multiple times. There's some discussion which of those texts is actually a commandment, which of those texts is a blessing you should be successful in multiplying. It is generally understood that the mitzvah of procreation is fulfilled when parents produce one boy and one girl. One issue, by the way, that I'm not going to be going into, I wanted to, but there was just no space for it, was the issue of adoption as a means of fulfilling this mitzvah. And there's a lot of very strong material in favor of that. It's just not our topic this morning, but once I mention fulfilling procreation, I should note that as a recognized option. If you take a look, though, at source number one, Rabbi Yosef Karo in the Shulchan Aruch, Code of Jewish Law, says, and I'm reading out my English translation, but you have the original Hebrew on the sheet as well, once a man, and he says man specifically for reasons that we'll get to, once a man has a male and female child, he has fulfilled the mitzvah of procreation. You need to produce, he says, a boy and a girl. There are multiple views presented in the Talmud, it's a Gemara and Yavamos, but that's the conclusion of the Shulchan Aruch. There's a second aspect of this mitzvah of procreation, and that is what's called la'erev. There is a verse in Koheles, in Ecclesiastes, which says, la'erev al tanach yadecha. You should keep on producing even in the evening. Even if you produced by day, you should keep on producing at night. And this is understood Talmudically, I brought it for you in source number two, as a statement that if you're doing things that God likes, if you're doing things that are good, keep on going, do more, even if you have already met your minimum obligation. So if you take a look at source number two, the Gemara in Yevamos, Rabbi Yoshua Omer, Rabbi Yoshua says, a man who marries a woman in youth should marry a woman in his older age. If he produced children in his youth, he should produce children in his older age. As it says, they quote the verse from Koheles, from Ecclesiastes, in the morning plant your seeds, in the evening do not stay your hand, you don't know which will be good, this, or if both will be good as one, who knows? So therefore, you should make sure that you continue pursuing children, don't stop because you've met the minimum. According to many rabbinic commentators, the Magid Mishnah commenting on the Rambam as an example, this is a rabbinic mitzvah as opposed to a biblical mitzvah. Dr. Kirshen, I see your note in the chat. I may come back to that. This is brought as halacha in the Shulchan Aruch in Eben Ezer Aleph Ches. Unclear to me how many children you need to have in order to satisfy this one. In other words, it's one boy, one girl for the core mitzvah. How many do you have to have in order to satisfy Rabbi Yoshua's extension of it? So when I spoke on the topic with Rivka Sonnenberg last year, she quoted Rabbi Yehuda Herzl Henkins, that's all, as saying one additional boy and one additional girl is the minimum for it. So it would be two and two. Okay. It's not entirely clear to me, but I'd have to see where he wrote about it or spoke about it originally. But that's your second aspect of the mitzvah. And then there is a third aspect. And Dr. Kirshen, I think this is what you were referring to. And that is sheves. The sheves is the idea of literally dwelling, residence, or civilization more broadly. And there is a pasuk, there's a verse in Yeshaya, which says about the world that God created, taking it a little bit out of context, but that's okay. Lo sohu bira'a la sheves yitzara. God did not create the world to be empty. He created it to be settled. He created it for the sake of it becoming civilized. In source number 3, the Mishnah in Gittin learns a lesson from this. It's dealing with a case which is fascinating in its own right and way beyond the scope of our discussion. It involves avdus. It involves slavery. And it's just not going to fit in this session to talk about slavery overall, but you have the following hypothetical case. You had somebody who was a slave to two masters. They owned the person in tandem. The status of this eved, the status of the slave, is that he's able to marry a woman who is also in this state of slavery. He's not able to marry somebody who's free. Then one of them frees his half. So now this eved, the slave, is stuck. He's half slave and he's half free. Now what do? He can't marry a free person because half of him is a slave. He can't marry a slave either because half of him is free. So what is he now able to do? And again, I'm not discussing morality of slavery. That's a great discussion for another time. But what's he supposed to do? So that's the question in this Mishnah in source number 3. If someone is half slave and half free, he serves his master one day, himself one day, according to Beit Hillel. Beit Shammai says, you can't do that because you have taken care of his master. So his master gets half service, but not him. He can't marry a maid, he's half free. He can't marry a free woman, he's half slave. Shall he do nothing? And then Beit Shammai says the part that's relevant for us. The world was created only for procreation. God wants the world to be filled. As the verse in Yeshaya and Isaiah goes, I just mentioned it, He, God, did not create the world to be empty. He formed it for settlement. So what did they suggest? They say, we compel the other master to free his half. And Beit Hillel says, you know, you're right. That's what we do. I just posted the link in the chat again for the source sheet. So this is the idea that separate from my personal obligation to produce children, there is an overall mandate of God wants the world to be settled. Halakhic authorities generally don't take this as a separate mitzvah. It's more a statement of a biblical value. It's God wants the world to be settled. This is, you know, what Hashem wants. Okay. By the way, I'm going to reiterate now. If you want to get a credit letter for having been here, please make sure you sign in the chat. You can send it to me as a private message. You can just put your name. You do not need to include your email address unless you're not on the email list for the classes. Then you need to include your email address. But otherwise, please just put in your name and that way I will know because I'm not recording video and I have no way to know otherwise who was here. Okay, thank you. So we have these three sources for producing children as a mitzvah. As we noted before in the agenda part, this is viewed as a mitzvah Rabbah, as a great mitzvah. I was actually going to include something on the sheet and decided not to. The Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, in the very beginning of the section of Eben HaEzer, which deals, among other things, with marriage, has a statement about a man's duty. And I didn't bring the text on the sheet because, as I said in the beginning, there are people who can't find a mate. There are people who aren't able to produce children. And the language there is so strong, I just didn't want to bring it. But I'm mentioning it in order to emphasize the strength of the way Judaism approaches producing children. It is considered to be a mitzvah rabbah. That comes out in source number 4. Source number 4 is a question that is asked by Tosfos. Tosfos is an anthology of commentaries from, as I wrote on the sheet, 12th, 13th century Western Europe, commentaries on the Talmud. He's bothered by source number 3. Source number 3 was where we talked about the importance of this eved, the slave, being able to produce children. But instead of bringing the text from the Torah of pru urvu, bear fruit and multiply, which is a biblical verse, you brought a verse from Isaiah about God wanting the world to be settled. So Tosfot asks the question, why did you bring me this verse about Shevet, about fulfilling the verse in Isaiah? Why didn't you bring the verse, bear fruit and multiply? That's, you know, if I have a choice when bringing a proof text between bringing a proof from Isaiah and bringing a proof from Bereishis, from Genesis should win. Why'd you bring the other verse? So the answer in source number 4 is this. It did not use the verse of bear fruit and multiply, because if he could fulfill some shevet, some procreation as a slave, we wouldn't compel his owner for the mitzvah of bear fruit and multiply. And here we do coerce the owner, as we have explained. So his first explanation has to do with a side point, which is related to whether if somebody reproduces as a slave, he's fulfilling bear fruit and multiply or only shevet. I'm not going into that. Rather, I'm going into his second answer. It cited this verse about shevet, about settling the world, because its language shows that this is a great mitzvah. Meaning, when God says bear fruit and multiply, it sounds like when God says all sorts of commandments. God says don't wear shatnez. God says don't perform halacha on Shabbos. God says remember the Shabbos day to keep it holy. All sorts of commandments in the Torah. This is another commandment in the Torah. As opposed to the language that Isaiah uses, where he says God did not create the world to be empty. God created it to be settled. That demonstrates how powerful this mitzvah is. Rav Eliyahu Dushnitzer, in source number 5, quotes the Brisker Rav, who said that there's another difference between the mitzvah of pru urvu, bear fruit and multiply, and the mitzvah of sheves, of settling the world. He says, the mitzvah of pru urvu, bear fruit and multiply, is personal. That's my individual mandate, my individual obligation. Whereas, l'sheves yitzara, settling the world, is a mitzvah for all Klal Yisrael, for all Jews. We all have this mitzvah of settling the world. The practical application of that is in terms of helping other people to be able to reproduce. If, for example, there's a way to help fund fertility treatments for people who are trying to have children, that's actually a mitzvah for all of us to provide. We should all be helping because it is a communal obligation, and that's why, in the case in source number 3, the master has to free the Eved. One side note, but worth noting, this idea of mitzvah rabbah, that it's a great mitzvah, it's a super mitzvah, applies to bearing fruit and multiplying. However, it doesn't necessarily apply to exceeding your obligation, going beyond the one and one. I brought a response in source number 6 from Rabbi Wozner, Shlomo Wozner in Israel, regarding IVF for people who already have children. Rabbi Wozner says if they already have children, they do not have this great mitzvah obligation in the same way that one who does not yet have children has it. So that's, I thought, worth knowing. Okay. So what we've said is you have this great mitzvah that one should try to be able to produce children. It comes from Pru Revu, this biblical commandment to bear fruit and multiply. We also have this extension of don't rest even after you have already fulfilled. But I noted before that this is worded in the Shulchan Aruch, in the Code of Jewish Law, as being for a man. Why? Take a look at source number 7, the Mishnah in Yevamos, which teaches us Ha'ish mitzuva al piria verivya avalov ha'isha. The view that is the main view in this Mishnah says a man is obligated in procreation. Women are not obligated in procreation. And Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka makes a comment, which on the face of it sounds logical. He says, what are you talking about? The language in the Torah for bear fruit and multiply is plural. Pru urvu. God says in the plural, you, plural in English doesn't work, because the word you doesn't work that way. But draw on my southern family connections. You all should bear fruit and multiply. It sounds like it should apply not just for men, but for women as well. Nonetheless, the view that is stated first here in source number 7 is the one that wins the day. Women are exempt from the obligation. I have to say, this sounds very strange, right? Given that historically in the human race, women have been the ones to give birth to the child. I think our track record is still at 100% on that one. Granted, technology may adjust that in the future, but how in the world could women be exempt from this mitzvah. So various explanations are offered. Some suggest it's that Hashem wouldn't obligate them to endanger themselves, because there is a concern, unfortunately, for maternal mortality in trying to give birth. It's still considered to be dangerous. Hashem isn't going to obligate them to endanger themselves. That's one answer that I've seen. Another answer is to point out that the way the Torah frames the mitzvah is actually pru urvu, bear fruit and multiply, umil ues haaretz, fill the earth, vichiv shuha, and conquer it. Establishing a family requires a degree of aggressiveness. And God says, well, it's not fair to expect that of the mother. I don't know about this answer, though, I have to say. I think the mother is the more aggressive one than the father in terms of what's needed in order to establish the family. Don't mess with the mother bear. Nonetheless, that's a second answer. The Meshech Chachma of Meir Simcha Kohen of Dvinsk said that go back and look at the Torah's system for marriage, the original biblical system. God allowed for polygamy. He said men and women, men are allowed to marry more than one wife. It maximizes pru urvu. It maximizes procreation if a man is able to marry more than one wife, because when one wife is pregnant, he can still impregnate the next one, and they could be able to have more children, as opposed to in the event that a woman were to marry more than one husband, in which case all the fertilizing men are tied up when she is pregnant or when she is nursing, and that defeats the goal of procreation. So the Meshech Chachma, Rabbi Meir Simcha HaKohen, says, what happens if a woman is married and her present husband is not able to have children, and she has an obligation of bearing fruit and multiplying? Are you going to force her now to divorce in order to be able to marry somebody else? God forbid. He says no. As opposed to the man who has the ability to marry another wife. So therefore, he can have the obligation. It's an interesting idea. Last suggestion I'll put out there, Rav David Shapiro wrote this. I think he was the one who was the principal of the Maimonides School in Boston for many years. He says, freeing women from the obligation to procreate teaches that the Torah doesn't view women as fertility machines. They can be themselves and they can develop themselves in addition to producing children. Those are some of the ideas that I've heard on this. I don't know if others have heard other ideas to explain how it is that you can exempt women from producing children. It just seems so counterintuitive. Anyone heard other thoughts on this? Okay. So hopefully some of those are even new for people. But because women are exempt from pru urvu, from bearing fruit and multiplying, they're also exempt from the extension of la'erev, of trying to continue to produce more children. Despite this, there are many reasons why women feel religious pressure to produce children. Part of it is the way we're educated. When you learn the Tanakh, and you start learning the very beginning of the Chumash, and we meet Sarah, who is unable to have children and wants Abram to be able to have a child and says you should marry Hagar. And then you have Rivka, who is not able to have children for 20 years, and she prays and her husband Yitzchak prays. And you have Rachel, who says to Yaakov, if I don't have children, I will die. And you have Hannah, and how she beseeches God or demands of God that she have a child. Like, this gets drummed into us from a very young age, that it's so important, and it creates a sense of pressure. That's number one. Number two, there is still religious value even without having the obligation. Rabbi Avram Gambiner, the Magen Avram, in his commentary to the Shulchan Aruch, to the Code of Jewish Law, in source number 8, talks about selling a Torah in order to enable a couple to marry. And he says that would be true to help a male orphan get married. He doesn't have anyone to support him. And also a female orphan in order to help her get married. Because, he says, even if bear fruit and multiply doesn't apply to females, Sheves, this idea that God wants the world to be settled, will apply for everyone. And that applies for men and it applies for women. I would also note, source number 9, Rabbi Chiel Michal Epstein in the Aruch HaShulchan, who says that even if you're exempt, that doesn't mean it isn't a mitzvah. He says it's really important to understand the Torah's hierarchy of obligations. There are things that you have to do, and then there are things which are great to do, but they're not an obligation upon you to do them. I'll give an example, although there are sources that will disagree with what I'm about to say, but what I'm saying is fairly mainstream. There is a mitzvah of Shiluach HaKan, right? In the event that I see a mother bird sitting on the eggs and I want the eggs, before I take the eggs, I should chase away the mother bird. It's a mitzvah. That does not mean that I have a mitzvah of go get a bird, right, in order to chase it away. If you want the eggs, chase away the mother. And again, I'm not going into, there are certain views on the mitzvah Shiluach HaKan, which actually may take it that way as an obligation, but the mainstream view is not that way. So if you take a look at source number 9, Rabbi Chiel Michal Epstein, the Aruch HaShulchan says, know that there is a great principle here. Even those who are not obligated to fulfill this mitzvah, still, when they procreate, they perform a mitzvah. A mitzvah versus a requirement is called optional. We call it optional because it's not required of them. And he says there's proof of this in a Medrash on Parshas Noach, which says that a man is more required in procreation than a woman. Not that he has the mitzvah and she doesn't. The man has more of an obligation. Therefore, she has a mitzvah, but she is not required to fulfill it. But it is absolutely a mitzvah. And then, of course, you could argue it's a meta-mitzvah. You're perpetuating the Jewish people. You're doing wonderful things. You're increasing mitzvahs in the world, the service of God in the world. How could we not view it as a mitzvah? Not to mention, on a practical level, with this current state of technology, men still need a woman to carry the baby to term. So women will feel a duty to enable the mitzvah. So much so, and this will conclude this section, source number 10, Rabbi Yitzchak Zilberstein, brought something very interesting. We're going to be talking later on about deciding not to have children, deciding not to pursue more children because it's dangerous for the child. But what about a case in which not pursuing children is dangerous for the mother? Meaning, the case we're dealing with in number 10 is where a mother is experiencing, not a mother, she, a woman is experiencing depression because she's been told it would be dangerous to her to produce children, and therefore she sees all her friends having children. She feels all the religious pressure that we just noted to have children. It's driving her into a depression. Is she allowed to endanger herself in order to try to produce children? So Rabbi Zilberstein in source number 10 says, my mentor and father-in-law, by which he means Rabbi Yashiv, a great halachic authority of the late 20th century, explained that were we not to permit her to produce children, she would be in potential danger since she very much wants children. Sorrow and pain could endanger her. As our mother Rachel said to our father Yaakov, give me children, otherwise I will die. And on that basis, he says, she is allowed to risk her own health to try to become pregnant, even though we normally, of course, are very protective of health, and even though she has no religious obligation to have a child. Nonetheless, we recognize that, certainly within Jewish society, as well as in the general world, there is pressure to have children. So all of this, everything we've done for the last half hour, has been to set up our cases. What happens when a family has reasons to stop or pause producing children, and especially when the main driver for pausing is the needs of the mother who isn't obligated to produce children? Where do things go? I'm going to pause here. Questions or comments? We got 58 screens here. Someone has to have a question. No, are we really? It was that clear? Okay. So I see a note in the chat which is worth noting, so I'm going to mention it now. Women, although not all, have such a natural and inherent desire to bring babies into the world and to nurture them that to call it a mitzvah for them is at least superfluous and at most demeaning. So I definitely hear the possibility of saying that. I'm not entirely sure I would say demeaning, but it reminds me of the discussion that that we always have this time of year, Yom HaAtzmaut, Yom Yerushalayim, when we're talking about the Sorry, I just had to do one thing on this computer. There we go. When we're talking about whether there is a mitzvah biblically of living in the land of Israel. And we note that the Rambam doesn't say anything about, anything explicit about there being such a mitzvah. So one of the answers is, yeah, but it's so clear in the Torah in so many different ways that of course it would be considered a mitzvah. So sort of along the lines of what was written in the chat. Okay. So there's a lot to be said. Certainly. Please, Dalia, go ahead. It's an interesting point. I sort of wonder if it would have gone the other way in terms of that social structure if it had been viewed as being a woman's obligation as well. In other words, maybe that's, you know, reversing cause and effect. We have, of course, the famous case, you know, of Tu B'Av and how, you know, the women would go to pursue a husband on the 15th of Av in the times of the Mishnah. And possibly earlier, depending on the roots of that story. But I wonder where things would have gone. It's certainly true that it would be very frustrating to be told you have an obligation, now you have to wait for a man to propose to you. That's for sure true. Someone asked me a question in the chat. Is it the same mitzvah to have a surrogate child? That is a very, very good question. Certainly from a Sheves perspective, right, settling the world, you have succeeded in settling the world. But I'm not 100% sure regarding Peruvu, and I want to think about that. I'm not 100% sure. I wonder, especially if it's not the surrogate's own egg, but it's the embryo was implanted from somebody else entirely. I wonder, well, on the other hand, I take that back. Since the mitzvah was on the male, not on her, so whether the woman who carries the baby to term is his wife or is somebody else's, or is somebody else, I don't know. I can see the argument that one does fulfill it. I just don't want to answer it on one foot. So I'm going to think it over. Maybe I'll put it into the follow-up email from the session, which is a good opportunity to remind people to sign in. Yes, Dr. Nussbaum. So it's an interesting question. It's actually there's halachic discussion both about a man divorcing his wife if she doesn't want to have children, and also a woman compelling the husband to divorce her if he is refusing to have children. As the Gemara talks about a woman complaining and saying, "I want a child to take care of me when I'm older." A very utilitarian type of approach. It always reminds me of the woman who I visited. I visited a woman in the hospital many years ago when I was a rub in the U.S. And she was an older Russian woman. And she asked me how many children I had. I told her, thank God I had four. And she said she only has two, and it was a big mistake because she doesn't have enough children now to visit her. You know, one visits one day, one visits the next day, and then the rest of the week. It's very difficult. She said you should have more children in order for them to visit you. That's what that Gemara always reminds me of. But yes, the answer in short is that refusal to have children may be grounds for divorce in Jewish law. That's the basic answer. Okay, so let's go.
Can I ask a question about the gold Schwartzes, or do you want
to leave these? Well, now I'm getting to the vignettes. So now we're going to get to them. So vignette number one, which we read out in the beginning, so I'm not going to read it out again, is the case in which a woman experienced heavy PPD, postpartum depression, after two births, was managed only with therapy and drug treatment. She wants to avoid future pregnancies. Is that an option? So we've discussed this on many occasions. Jewish law takes mental illness, depression, and general mental illness very, very seriously. I gave you one example of it in source number 11, Rabbi Dr. Avram Sofer Abraham in the Nishmas Avram, who talks about violating Shabbos for somebody who's dealing with depression. He says a patient with a serious psychological condition, such as deep depression, such that we are concerned he might endanger himself or others, is in the class of Chol Sheyesh Bo Sakana, dangerously ill. We violate Shabbos for this patient as needed. And that's very, very straightforward. There are lots of responsa on this. We've discussed it in other sessions. So we have many sources going back decades instructing to use birth control to avoid pregnancy in a case of dangerous depression or depression which could become dangerous. Classic example is source number 12, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein writing about this. Rabbi Feinstein passed away in 1986. He wrote about this, I think, in the 60s, maybe the 70s. He says, regarding a woman who became a shota, feminine version of shote, somebody who has lost their rationality. So she became a shota after the birth of her two children, such that the doctors forbid further pregnancy. May she use contraception? That's the question that is put to him. Oh, the date is on it. I didn't notice. 1961. So his answer is, certainly his honor, the person writing to him, is correct. The state of shota is dangerous not only for herself, but also for her small children. Even one whose shtut, the state of being a shote, does not currently incline towards harm, could still change, wanting to harm herself or her children, God forbid. One cannot stand guard for this. You can't say, let her have children and we'll just look, keep on the lookout. Therefore, one should permit her. He says, absolutely. And if we have time at the end, in our last vignette, we'll talk about which options for birth control are better or worse. Okay. I see someone message me in the chat. I always prefer these to be out loud. It's hard to monitor at the same time. And yes, it is true. They noted in the chat that high-risk women used to be hospitalized for months and be on complete bed rest. This is true. Okay. So that's relatively straightforward. I actually noted for you also a response from Rav Yitzchak Weiss. Rav Weiss, a contemporary of Rabbi Feinstein, dealt with a case in which a woman wanted to pursue pregnancy, but there was a major risk to her health in doing so, and he said she doesn't have the right to pursue pregnancy. You know, question, putting that against the comment from Rabbi Zilberstein in source number 10. But he wrote, Mama hani ritzona bazem dina hachi. What does the patient's desire have to do with this if this is the law? That's the way it goes. He says you have to guard your life. You can't choose a dangerous pregnancy. That's the position that he took. Rose, yeah.
I just want to ask, if you have a congenital abnormality, for example, I'm thinking of postpartum depression, like it's very highly genetically linked, and the next generation can have it. Now, postpartum depression is still not the worst. Like, if you have a severe disorder, and you're going to transmit it, and there's a very high chance, I'd say more than 50% chance of transmitting it, are you still obligated to do the pruefu?
So you're asking two different questions, I thought. The first question is, what if you have somebody who likely is vulnerable to PPD if they become pregnant? And then the second question is transmitting such things to the next generation. So in terms of the first part of your question, this is largely a medical question, meaning while you noted a possible heredity, the evidence on heredity of mental illness is not clear-cut, at least as I've read it. I looked into it a couple of years ago, but it's not so clear-cut. But you would definitely need to consult experts on that in terms of the predisposition and the level of risk involved. Once you know the level of risk involved, then the rabbi can weigh in and say, well, if this is the level of risk, then that's what I would advise. But you need more medical information first. It is entirely possible to say prospectively, without her ever having been pregnant before, there's too much of a danger. But you need medical expertise to be able to speak to that. In terms of the latter part of it, we're going to get to that, God willing, in case number 4. Excuse me. Where there's a danger to the child. And God willing, we'll get to that and we'll talk about that then. Okay. That's in terms of vignette number one. Vignette number one, like I said, is relatively straightforward in the halachic literature. What about number two? You have, Esther, yeah.
I just wanted to make a plea that I hope we get to vignette number five when you actually talk about what birth controls are permitted, because that's an extremely practical and helpful question. So I'm just making a plea to make sure we have time, because I don't want to look like I'm being manipulative.
Thank you.
Just making a comment.
I appreciate it. It's always a challenge because you want there to be interaction. I want there to be interaction. It's not a good learning experience if there isn't interaction. But I take your point for sure. I also feel like vignette number five might disappoint because I'm not going to say anything terribly novel. But all right, let's go forward. The strained family, the Goldschwartzes. So the question was, Sarah the therapist can see how strained they are. They have three children ages four and under, thanks to twins. They're in counseling. They're dealing with financial trouble. Physically, it's a huge strain. Now we have the baby formula shortage to add to our problems. What are we going to do for these people? Is it worthwhile to have them consult their rabbi? So first of all, it's always good to speak to your rabbi. Have a conversation with your rabbi, definitely. That's number one. To me, the first critical question in the conversation is this. Are we entitled, given everything we said in the first half hour about how important procreation is, are we entitled to have this conversation from an emotional and psychological standpoint? People have to ask, is it okay for me to say, I don't want to have more children? Does that make me a bad person? Like, that's a counseling question that people have to deal with. Does it make me ungrateful for the children I have if I'm saying that I want to stop at a certain point? That's really its own issue. But from the perspective of Judaism, is it valid to say, I know this is an important mitzvah, but I want to stop? So I deliberately minimized the halachic aspect of this by saying they already have fulfilled pruravu. They have their one son, they have their one daughter, they're now in the area of la'erev, of saying, yeah, but you should keep on having children. I'm also going to stipulate that they would use a type of contraceptive which is minimally problematic on the hierarchy of contraceptives, because that's a question we'll leave for number five. So that's not our issue here. But the answer is there are halachically valid reasons to refrain from having children. Aside from the very severe case that we talked about health, the health of the mother earlier. Number one, concern for physical pain. Take a look at source number 14, a Gemara in Yevamos. Yehudis was the wife of Rabbi Chia. She had pain from giving birth. She had already produced multiple children. They had satisfied Pururavu. She changed her clothing, disguised herself, and came before Rabbi Chia and asked him, is a woman commanded in procreation? I don't know what kind of disguise this was, but she has some kind of disguise such that he doesn't know who is asking her, who was asking the question. Is she commanded? And he said to her, no. Just because, and again, there's no mitzvah for her, and she had pain, and she went and drank a potion of sterilization. She drank some herbal thing that would keep her from producing children. The Ritva, Rabbi Yom Tov Alasvili, commenting on this Gemara, emphasizes this was not a danger to health case. This was a case in which it was painful to produce children, and she had had enough. Fast forward to the 20th century, and a response from Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, which talks about this desire not to produce children further. He's talking about, at first, the case in which the father says, I don't want to continue. So he writes, he expresses his answer regarding his great honors question. If, since he, the husband, is sick, lo aleinu, God forbid we shouldn't have such a thing, but since the husband is sick, and it is hard for him to raise children, the question is, could he marry a woman with the intent that she act in a way that she will not become pregnant? Is a man entitled to marry a woman And she will make sure that they don't produce children. Birth control, whatever the method is. Rabbi Feinstein answers, it is obvious that one cannot permit this. No way, he says. For the entire permission that one may sometimes give is in a case of danger to the woman. There are means one may permit, even if her illness is not dangerous, but only involves great pain. But not for the difficulty of raising children and lack of livelihood and the like. It is not relevant to permit for the man who does not have the illness and pain of pregnancy and birth, but only difficulty from other issues. Rabbi Feinstein says, in terms of the man, no. The man saying, it's difficult to have children, it's a lot of responsibility, Rabbi Feinstein says, that is not sufficient grounds. However, implicit in his answer is for the mother's pain and suffering, yes. That is sufficient grounds to already say she is not obligated to pursue, and she could, in fact, use birth control. Rav Asher Weiss deals with this issue as well in articles in a couple of places, talking about tzar, talking about pain. Another issue that comes up within such cases, what about resources of money and time to support the existing family, as well as to support the newborn, right? Because it's not only an issue of what about the new child, but also an issue for the existing children. So what would we say about that? So outside the realm of reproduction, financial concerns are halachically significant. We have a principle which is taught in the Mishnah, Chas HaKadosh Baruch Hu al Mamonim Shel Yisrael. God is concerned about our financial means, and it has practical applications in various laws. We have a passage in the Talmud which says, Ein HaKadosh Baruch Hu ba'bitrunya im briyosav. God doesn't play gotcha games with us. If it's going to be too difficult, he's not going to make that an obligation upon us. We have a cap on spending for certain for mitzvot in general. So we have a recognition that financial concerns matter in Jewish law. On the other hand, when it comes to procreation, halachic authorities tend to be less likely to accept this argument. The Chafetz Chaim, Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan, Rav in Poland in the first part of the 20th century, dealt with the following situation. The government took young men into the army from ages 21 to 27. As a result, the young men would delay marriage until after they got out of the army. Rabbi Kagan, the Chafetz Chaim, argued they should marry earlier and even produce children, even though they know they will be absentee fathers for 6 years. Because, he says, look at the Jews in Egypt. When they were suffering terribly and they had no means, they still produced children. If you take a look at source number 16, this is a medrash that he quotes on it, which says, the Jews made wedding parties for their sons and daughters in Egypt. The Egyptians said to them, why do you make parties when after an hour we will take them out for oppression and suffering? And the Jews replied, we will make a party, and then you do as you wish. You do what you want, we're going to do what we want. That's the argument of the Chafetz Chaim, and it's similar to what we saw in Rabbi Feinstein, who said that in the case where the father didn't want to produce children because he was concerned about his means, that wasn't sufficient grounds. Now, there is one difference, and I see your hand. Hold on 1 second. There was one difference in that Rabbi Feinstein's case was a case, I believe, where the father had not fulfilled Peruvu at all yet. He had not procreated at all. Once you have fulfilled and you're now dealing with the rabbinic mitzvah of pursuing further children, it's a different story. But the upshot for me, for our second vignette, is that absolutely the Goldschwartzes should be talking to their rabbi because physical pain, as well as the emotional pain, may well be grounds for them saying, you know, we need to put a pause on this, and particularly because they have already fulfilled Peruvu, they fulfilled the biblical mitzvah at this stage. Dr. Todd.
I just had a question with respect to our current state of
medicine, we have technology to allow patients who are have trouble naturally to get pregnant, and we also have epidurals and stuff like that. Does the Torah look at the obligations more from a supernatural perspective? Like, I would assume that if we're not obligated to spend lots and lots of money on fertility treatments, if we're having trouble on our own. And I also was just thinking about the epidural question, like now we have epidurals in some ways of controlling pain in pregnancy or delivery. Would that be all of an argument or can people just on the basis of natural childbirth opt out?
Right. So those are both good questions. If you go back to the beginning of the source sheet, I gave you a link for the class that we had in 2017 on fertility treatments. And I believe that there I discussed the question of whether there is an obligation to actually pursue fertility treatments. But I don't remember the class well enough 5 years later to feel comfortable quoting it. So what I'm going to do is look back in my notes about it and include it in the follow-up email, rather than risk getting it wrong on something like this. I always worry because in addition to the fact that, you know, not everybody reads follow-up emails, but also you put out a recording of something and the people who are listening to the recording aren't going back to the follow-up email. So I want to avoid saying something that is incorrect. But that which we said there regarding pursuing IVF, is that an obligation or not, will also affect the second part of your question of, when we factor in considerations about pain, do we go based on just the natural state of pain, or do we say, well, there are things you can do to mitigate it, like the epidural? I think part of that question is also effectiveness, meaning there's a, you know, I think, and I'll defer to the medical professionals, I think there's a certain level of confidence about epidurals working. But if we were to transfer that over to the emotional pain issue and therapy and medication for depression, that definitely does not hold. I have a lot more faith in the epidural than I do in therapies that we have for depression. So I think we need to distinguish in terms of level of confidence and, of course, level of investment. What's it going to cost me to have an epidural versus what would it cost for you know, therapies and so forth? So it's a little more complicated than I'm going to be able to answer right now, but I want to look back at my notes on the IVF question in terms of whether it's an obligation. Mark?
What if the Goldschwartzes went for therapy because they're in their first year of marriage and things are a bit rocky and they want to hold off?
Mm-hmm. So there you have a couple of complications, right? And thank you, Dr. Stern, for noting in the chat that epidurals are not risk-free. Thank you. Number one, things are rocky in first years of marriages routinely. You know, as opposed to we have three children age four and under. That's definitely not, you know, routine burden. Number two, they now have not fulfilled pruravu at all. I am aware of halachic authorities in Israel who do endorse use of birth control early in a marriage to help the couple to have time to get their feet under them where they sense that that's a need. So I know that there are those who do it. I think you need more specifics of the situation. I don't think that's a one-size-fits-all. I think you need to know that there's a real strain beyond the norm in order to feel comfortable endorsing that. I think that's what I would say. I'm certainly not, you know, of a level to say flat one way or the other. I think you need to know more about the specifics of a situation. I wouldn't say it's never okay, but there's a high threshold to meet. That's what I would say. Okay. So let's get to vignette number three. Vignette number three is the we've had enough vignette. The Goldschwartzes had their 5 year pause. Their children are now 9, 7, and 7. But they have found that having a calm family life is actually doing wonders for them. And they want to extend the pause, not under the same pressures as they were, but just because, you know, we did fulfill Puravu. Are we entitled to say, La Erev Al Tanach, you know, you're not supposed to stop, but on the other hand, that's a rabbinic mitzvah. So, and again, we're talking about people who, their means of birth control is not going to be the extremely problematic type. We're not talking about surgery. We're not talking about something like that. We're not talking about something irreversible. Again, we'll talk about that when we get to vignette number five, God willing. So it's easy to bring arguments against the Goldschwartzes to say, you have to keep on going. As a general principle, we are supposed to want more mitzvos. We love God. Even if we're exempt, we want to take things on. I brought you source number 17. It's a very misunderstood source. It's a Gemara in Yuma, which has the sage Rav say, Avram fulfilled the entire Torah. How do you know that? Because look what God said. God says, to a later generation, to Yitzchak, because Avram listened to my voice, he guarded my preserve, my commandments, my statutes, and my teachings. Mishmarti mitzvosai chukosai v'sorosai. He did everything of mine. So, therefore, the Gemara says, Avram fulfilled every mitzvah. Now, people get so hung up on this and ask, well, what does that mean? Did he fulfill Pesach when the Jews hadn't even gone down to Egypt yet? And, this rabbinic mitzvah, did he fulfill this rabbinic mitzvah? Like, you're missing the point. The point the Gemara is trying to say is that Abraham and Sarah and their immediate descendants observe all those, even though those mitzvahs have not been given yet. There's a concept of voluntary acceptance of obligations that the Torah and the Gemara here are trying to teach us. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein has a well-known responsum. He was asked the question by a youth group. They wanted to hold a tiyul. This is in Israel. They wanted to have their youth go out on a trip during Chol HaMoed Sukkot, right? The intermediate days of the holiday. If you are traveling, you are exempt from the mitzvah of Sukkah. So their question was, it's convenient time, get the kids out, and they have a tiyul. There are all sorts of redeeming value things that they get out of being on these trips together. Not to mention their parents have the redeeming value of the children being out of their house and less likely to end up like the Goldschwartzes. So can the youth group do this and say, well, we're exempt from the sukkah? And Rav Aaron goes through the practical questions of, are you exempt from sukkah? But he says, we want to show enthusiasm for mitzvot and the way we educate children. Like, deliberately creating an event on Sukkot in which they're going to eat without a sukkah, right? And not sleep in a sukkah. Remember, you're in Israel, well, that's actually, more reasonable than Toronto. He said, you're defeating your purpose. Like, ask yourself if that's really what you want. Our general approach to pursue mitzvot, and we have a halachic framework, I'm now going beyond what Rav Aaron said. We have a halachic framework for exceeding obligations because there is more to the Torah than the letter of the law. There is the spirit of the law. I mentioned in the beginning of our session, Rav Asher Weiss is going to be having a Zoom later on at 1 o'clock today. On Ve'ahavta l'recha kamocha, love your neighbor as yourself. I am fairly sure that at some point he will invoke the following principle, which he loves to talk about. Ratzon ha-Torah, the desire of the Torah. He says, in addition to letter of the law, there is knowing what God wants us to do. His contact in source number 18, he's talking about a chayal, a soldier who was on guard duty all night. He gets back to his base early in the morning, too early to be able to daven. And the question is, can he go to sleep knowing that once he goes to sleep, he's not going to wake up to daven? But right now, he's exempt. He's in the period before you're actually able to daven. So he writes in source number 18, one who keeps himself from becoming obligated in a mitzvah before its time arrives has not failed in the mitzvah. If you go to sleep and then you can't wake up, you didn't violate anything. However, the desire of the Torah, Ratzon HaTorah, places an expectation upon people to make certain they will be able to fulfill mitzvot and indeed pursue their fulfillment. We look to enable ourselves to do a mitzvah. We don't pursue exemptions. And that comes up in familiar halachic categories. In our relationship with other people, we have the concept of lifnim mishuras hadin, that even when we are not obligated to do something for others, nonetheless, we're supposed to go beyond in our relationship. And our relationship with Hashem, with God, we have a concept of a baal nefesh, somebody who is able to do more than they are obligated to do. So I could easily argue to the Goldschwartzes, I don't want to, isn't really sufficient. However, you can also argue in favor of the Goldschwartzes. Number one, they are, at this point, exempt from the biblical mitzvah of pruvu, right? They have the rabbinic one, but they have fulfilled the biblical mitzvah. Number two, as far as ratzon ha-Torah, the desire of the Torah, Hashem left that unspecified, right? Hashem didn't say, and I want you to keep on going. We have this rabbinic mitzvah, but God didn't say it. That really, that suggests that it depends on your situation. Rav Soloveitchik wrote this regarding the concept of lefnim mishuras hadin, of going beyond the letter of the law in general. Take a look at source number 19 from his work Halachic Morality. Well, Halachic Morality is assembled from his writings. Besides possessing derech hachayim, a Torah way of life, we also have a Torah style of living, what we may call a signon hachayim. The difference between a way of life and a style of living relates to the basic difference between din, law, and lefnim mishuras hadin, transcending the line of the law. Din, the law, belongs under the rubric of derech hachayim, the style of religious life. There is one way of Jewish life, but there are a variety of styles of how to experience God while performing one's duty. And the Gemara says, when the Torah says that Moshe should teach the Jews, or Yisro says that Moshe should teach the Jews to do, that they should do, Ma'aseh Asher Ya'asun. This refers to going beyond the letter of the law, each person in his own manner or style, to explain that a little bit more, because the text is a little hard to work with. What Rav Soloveitchik said is that when God gives us laws, those laws are for everyone. But when he says, I want you to go beyond the letter of the law, that's subjective. Each person has to find their individual way to do that. And so you could make the argument, this is not going to be their way. And as far as going lefnim mishuras hadin, going beyond the letter of the law, we have a line in Tosfos like that in source number 20, who says specifically it's not an unlimited obligation. Now, I'm making a push for this, trying to argue on behalf of the Goldschwartzes, even though, honestly, I have to feel like it's still too much, because here, la erev al tanach yadecha, right, to continue, is a rabbinic mitzvah. In other words, it's not as though I have fulfilled all my obligations and now it's just about what would God want of me. Rabbinic mitzvahs are mitzvahs. So, yeah, I have to stress that. At the same time, it's a rabbinic mitzvah without a limit on it. Right? It's a rabbinic mitzvah. You know, I mentioned in the beginning the idea that maybe it refers to having one more son, one more daughter. But I don't have a clear-cut understanding of why that should be true. So we're playing in a little bit of a vague area. One thing that I do know, though, that I think is very important to keep in mind, is that exceeding one's obligations can be destructive. We have a classic line in Shalmi, the Jerusalem Talmud, if you look at source number 21. Rabbi Elazar said, just as one may not declare the tameh, the ritually impure, to be tahor, to be pure, so one may not declare the tahor to be tameh. You're not free to say usser, to say prohibited, to say chayiv, so that you're obligated when one is not obligated. This is brought as halacha by the Shach of Shabbos HaKohen. Just as we may not permit the prohibited, so we may not prohibit the permitted. It can be destructive. There can be fallout to it. So you have to be really careful. And that goes to the point about Andrea's comment in the chat. What if having more children will put them in the same situation they were in before? Right? You're going to end up back where they were. That's exactly the question. Is, you may think, well, I'm doing what God wants me to do, but what if it really is something that you can't bear? Now what? So this really requires a consult with sensitive counseling from a secular side, as well as sensitive halachic advice. This isn't an easy one to answer. The fact that they got their first 5 years does not mean that they get the next 5 years. I think it's I think it's not straightforward. I saw the question in the chat about the difference between Rav Asher Weiss's concept of Ratzon HaTorah and Das Torah, but that is so far beyond the scope of where we are right now, and I do want to get to vignettes 4 and 5. So I'm going to pass on that one. Okay. Comments and questions on vignette 3. Okay. So right now what we know is threat to the mother's health, for sure you stop. Physical pain for the mother, emotional pain for the mother, grounds definitely to be discussed with the rabbi. Financial concerns, we seem to have less sympathy for. Deciding we've had enough may be a factor. Discuss it with the rabbi. There can be an argument made for it, but it's definitely harder as a justification. So what about when a couple is pursuing pururvu, they want to have children, but there are risks to fetal health, right? The question that Rose started to ask before. If you take a look at vignette number 4. The Bookbulls married in their mid-30s. These names are generic names. I mean, obviously, someone wrote something in the chat about knowing a Bookbull family. This is not from anybody. Names have not been changed. Names have been made up. The goal here was an Ashkenazi family and a Sephardi family. That's all. So the Bookbulls married in their mid-30s and have been unsuccessfully pursuing IVF for years. Now, as Mrs. Bookbull approaches age 43, and I chose age 43 because that's the age where OHIP will no longer cover IVF, Mrs. Bookbull's doctor expresses concern for possible birth defects on the basis of their age. May the Bookbulls pursue a child risking birth defects? That's the question. Clearly, you need a lot of medical information, and it may vary in terms of the medical side of things. I didn't intend to give a medical psak with this item. There is a halachic debate regarding fulfilling pru'urvu with children who have birth defects that prevent them from growing to maturity and producing children of their own. God forbid, you know, someone produces a child who doesn't make it to maturity. That's its own question. I'm not going into that issue. It's a fascinating debate, but beyond the scope of where we are right now. Yes, Rose. Yeah, we'll get to that.
And take a look at this amniocentesis and CDS.
We're going to it.
Okay.
You are correct. You are 100% correct. There is testing available, and that's part of our discussion.
Okay.
You got
Sorry.
It. No, that's fine. So before PGD was an option, and before, you know, amniocentesis was considered to be that reliable to be able to actually... no. Prominent halachic authorities said if they have not yet produced a son and a daughter, they should proceed. Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach was uncertain about this. I brought in source number 22, a translation of his. I didn't bring the original Hebrew there because my edition of Mincha Shlomo doesn't have the Hebrew. So I would have had to retype the whole thing like, without cutting and pasting it. So you just have my English translation. He said, I am uncertain regarding one who has a genetic disease and his children will live all their lives in pain, or one who suffers from hemophilia, which passes to males. May he refrain from fulfilling procreation, marrying a woman who cannot produce children. One is not obligated to spend more than 1/3 or 1/5 of his funds for a mitzvah, even if the mitzvah is only available temporarily. So that's a principle, I noted it before, about God saying, I don't want you to have to spend everything you have. Well, this man feels that his pain and that of his children are worth much more than 1/3 of his assets, right? If he could spend all of that to avoid that problem, he would. So that's the argument of, he should not produce children. Or should we say, one should not investigate such circumstances? For this we say, what business do you have in the secrets of the Merciful One? The line from the Gemara in Brachos, when Chizkiyahu does not want to have children because he's been told that his son will be wicked? And Yeshaya's answer is, that's not your business. You do what is on you to do. So Rav Shlomo Zalman brings both sides, and he leaves it as Tzarachiyun. He says, I don't know. various halachic authorities said, use the best testing available. So that you have Rav Moshe Feinstein's response in source number 23. You have a parallel one in the Tzitz Eliezer, of Eliezer Waldenberg. But I chose the Rav Moshe one because he deals with a case in which he actually mentions what the issue was. It was Marfan's syndrome. The Tzitz Eliezer, Rav Waldenberg does not mention it, but for those who want to look it up, it's in Tzitz Eliezer, Tesvav Mem Gimel. So, Rav Feinstein, in source number 23, regarding a 25-year-old man who has Marfan syndrome, which is congenital and causes weakness of the heart, eyes, and sinews, and he has it in a severe form, such that he has already needed heart surgery, and he is blind in one eye. If he were to marry a woman and produce sons and daughters, based on what has been observed so far, there is a 50% chance that they would also have this illness. Is it prohibited for him to marry a woman who can produce children? Or just the opposite, is he obligated to take a woman who can produce children to fulfill the mitzvah of procreation? Right? Notice the polls. Either it's prohibited, or it's a requirement. Right? It's not like a toss-up. It is obvious, in my humble opinion, that if he can find a woman who knows of his illness, for he certainly must reveal it to her before Kiddushin, lest it be a mistaken Kiddushin, and even aside from the concern that it's a mistaken Kiddushin, there's a prohibition against Ona'a in marriage, as there is in financial matters. Perhaps it is even more severe. You can't deceive her. Yeah, lest anyone have any doubt. She has to know. Ideally also before the wedding date, but he is permitted and even obligated to marry her due to the mitzvah of procreation. If she knows about the illness and she's good with it, he has to marry her. They could produce whole and healthy sons and daughters. He could hope and pray to Hashem that he produce sons and daughters who are whole and healthy. Use the best testing available and go ahead. That's the position of Rabbi Feinstein. That's the position of Rabbi Waldenberg. Well, now that you have PGD, pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, so you have the option of creating a zygote, right? Having this pre-embryo tested in the lab, having a set of pre-embryos tested in the lab, and then they will implant the one that, or the ones that, they believe do not have this vulnerability. So, there is a concern in certain halakhic quarters about disposing of the embryos that will not be used. They may create 5, 6, 7 embryos, and they're not using 4 of them or 5 of them. What happens now? Rabbi J. David Bleich argued that that is a prohibited abortion. That was his argument. I brought it in source number 24. He says, I see no reason to distinguish between aborting something that is in the mother and aborting something that is outside of the mother. I looked to see, this is an old article, 2002, I looked to see if he had said anything more recent on it that changed from that, and I could not find anything. However, many halachic authorities disagree. In other words, Rabbi Bleich's position could potentially ban, PGD, unless you're going to say freezing the embryo is not the same thing as disposing of it. That's an argument that may be made. But many halachic authorities disagree, saying this does not qualify as abortion. If you go to that link that I gave you in the beginning for the class that I gave about abortion in 2018, we noted there that that there are various reasons behind prohibitions against abortion. The reasons don't really apply when you're talking about this kind of pre-embryo. One of the prohibitions against abortion is that you're harming the mother. You're physically harming the mother. You're wounding her. That's not the case here. That isn't even inside of her. The argument that you're wounding a fetus, Rav Yechidak of Weinberg, the Sweet H, said it won't apply here because it has not yet formed a limb to be wounded. It's a free embryo. There is a concern potentially of wasting seed. That is true. However, it's not a waste. It's with the goal of producing life. The fact that you also produced these pre-embryos that you're not going to use doesn't change that. There's a biblical verse about somebody who spills the blood of man in man, but this pre-embryo is not inside a human being. So many halachic authorities, and I think this is the trend in our day, do not take the position of Rabbi Bleich and argue, in fact, that PGD is permitted. But because you have this opposition, that makes things a little bit complicated. I'm not going into, again, as I said in the beginning, I'm not going into the U.S. Supreme Court decision, but yes, that absolutely could have an impact, as noted in the chat, on PGD, scarily enough. But the result for our case is a debate. Some contend that just like halachic authorities encouraged the tests before PGD came along, they said do amniocentesis, whatever, so too now you also should be doing PGD. That should be encouraged. And some authorities actually require PGD if there is a risk that the child could have a defect. They say if you're going to produce children, you have an obligation to do it in a way that is going to avoid the defect. Rav Asher Weiss has a tshuva, if you take a look at source number 25, regarding parents who are both carriers of a recessive gene for a disease. Rose, I see your hand, but I'm going to go through this this case first. You have parents who are both carriers of a recessive gene for a particular disease. He said, there is no mitzvah of procreating in such a case with this severe disease that they had. I don't remember which disease it was. I suspect he didn't say it in the responsum. If I find it before I send out the follow-up email, I'll include it. But he said there was no mitzvah in such a case. However, they should be encouraged to produce children using PGD. Take a look at number 25, my translation. It appears that if one is exempt from a mitzvah due to his own suffering, even though he has a personal obligation, then how much more so is he exempt when fulfilling the mitzvah, which could cause unsurpassable pain to others, right? A person is exempt because of their own pain from a mitzvah. How much more so the pain they could inflict on this child? And many times more so when it would cause a life of pain for an unborn child. It appears according to this, that when there is great concern that the children produced will have defects in their body and mind, and in the natural order of things, their lives will be lives of suffering and indescribable pain, he is exempt from procreation. And since this man is actually obligated in the mitzvah of procreation, it's only that we exempt him in practice because of concern that he might produce a child with a defect. In other words, he's capable of reproducing. He has a mitzvah. He's just not able to because of this issue. So he says, one should encourage him to do this, to procreate with PGD. And although I know that many giants of Israel in the previous generation did not approve this treatment, they did not approve IVF, in our case, where this man is obligated and able to procreate, all will agree that this is the way to fulfill his obligation. That's what he should do. This is brought by Rabbi Dr. Avram Steinberg in Arefuah Kahalacha as well. I brought you my translation of it in source number 26. He talks about the importance of being careful with IVF to, you can see what I brought you in 26, but he says he's not just saying that himself. He heard that from Rabbi Yashiv. He heard that from Rabbi Moshe Halberstam. He heard that from Yeshua Neubert. Rabbi Aryeh Katz in an article in Truman from a couple of years ago says the same thing in source number 27. I'm just rushing because I want to get to vignette number 5. But this is absolutely the trend in halacha against the position of Rabbi Bleich that yes, they should use PGD, and that's what they should do. However, Rabbi Steinberg does say one thing that I thought was particularly interesting in source number 28, talking about a case where there is only one carrier in the couple and the gene is recessive. In such a case, there's no way the child is going to have the actual illness. At most, the child will be a carrier. So he says, one may use PGD even when the issue is that one mate carries a recessive gene on condition that IVF was required and practiced anyway due to fertility problems. But one may not carry out a process of IVF and PGD only to avoid a situation of carrying a recessive gene. He says, IVF and PGD are problematic enough that we're not going to do it just to avoid a carrier situation. It has to have some other reason for being used. I know people probably want to discuss that, but we have 6 minutes and I do want to get to vignette number 5 in some measure. So that's what I'm going to do, and I'm going to stick around for questions and comments at the end. So what does stopping actually look like? What are the options? So as you may have noticed in yesterday's parsha, because it actually came up there, there is a biblical prohibition against sirus, I apologize. For those in Israel, it wasn't yesterday's parsha, it was last week's parsha. Fine. Nonetheless. There is a prohibition against, as it's stated biblically, doing something to a man that will prevent the man from having children. It's more refined than that. If you go to my class from 2011 that I linked in the beginning of the source sheet, you can see much, much more about it, which types of surgery are prohibited, but I can stipulate that a vasectomy is going to be a problem. And that you see in the Shulchan Aruch in source number 29, the Code of Jewish Law. For women, it's not, as explicit there in the Torah. Nonetheless, it is still prohibited. The only question is, what is the nature of the prohibition? It is also found in source number 29 from the Shulchan Aruch. The Vilna Gaon argued that it's what's called an Isur Aseh, which is a very interesting way to frame it. It is a prohibition that is stated in the positive as opposed to the negative in the Torah. Rav Moshe Feinstein took the view of the Vilna Gaon very seriously. Others argue that it is a rabbinic prohibition. But the bottom line is that it's very hard to justify surgery as a means of preventing producing more children. The question does come up, what if the surgery is reversible? We find this addressed in a responsum of Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, as well as a responsum of the Tzitz Eliezer, Rabbi Waldenberg. Rabbi Feinstein dealt with it regarding vasectomy. The Tzitz Eliezer dealt with it regarding tubal ligation. Neither of them liked it. Rabbi Feinstein said there might be room for leniency if the procedure lapses naturally. If you're talking about something that naturally gets reversed over time, which is not the case, obviously, in a vasectomy. But the Tzitz Eliezer had leniencies, it brought it in source number 30, where the procedure can be reversed, where it's a temporary obstruction. And others who have written on this since then have suggested it depends a little bit on whether the procedure is a blockage or is a severing. Meaning, if it's a severing, it's more problematic. If it's a blockage, then the part of the body functions normally, it's just that right now there's an obstruction which can be reversed. So that there may be greater grounds for leniency. It also depends on the level of intervention necessary in order to restore function. In practice, I am told by medical professionals that when people go in for a vasectomy, when people go in for a tubal ligation, they're told that this is not reversible. It's not initiated as a reversible procedure, lechatchila, so to speak. Where we do find more leniencies is when you start to deal with intratubal devices, ITDs, silicone plugs. And this is a procedure that is used that's less extreme than surgery, but basically you're blocking the fallopian tubes with a silicone plug. I know there was a coil that was used and then discontinued for medical reasons. It is generally considered, as I understand it, and please correct me if I'm wrong, it is generally considered medically permanent to have a silicone plug. I know that halachic authorities are not in favor. Thank you for the note in the chat supporting that point about the surgical sterilization being permanent. My understanding is that Yehuda Herzl Henkin was not in favor of intratubal devices of silicone plugs. Where you find greater leniency is when you deal with either an IUD or you deal with medication. First of all, medication which might render a man temporarily impotent, but it will naturally reverse itself when the medication's effect fades. So medication is called sirus. It is called removal of one's procreative abilities in Jewish law, such that men are not supposed to do it as a general principle. However, Rav Moshe Feinstein wrote what I have for you in source number 31. He says, if I weren't afraid to say this, I would say that the prohibited cup of roots that the Talmud talks about, the herbal potion, is specifically where this sterilizes a person's evarim. It's actually doing something to the body parts. Not only where they are visibly damaged, but even if the damage is that they can't function properly, this is also damage. But if it is such a cup of roots that does not damage at all, but only removes the life force from the seed, but he functions properly and can engage in relations as before, there is no prohibition. This is not serious at all. He says, if you're talking about a pill that a man is able to take, which will cause his sperm to be less fertile, Then he says there is definite grounds for leniency. That's a point that Rabbi Feinstein makes. Hormonal implants for women, right? An IUD. So those we tend to be much more lenient about. They're temporary, first of all, in their use, and they're easily reversible. So those halachic authorities tend to be more lenient about. And birth control pills, they'll be lenient about as well. There's no physical damage to the organs. It's taken by the woman who is not obligated in pruravu. She's not obligated in producing children. The sexual act is a normal sexual act. So that tends to have the greatest leniency as well. You know, like I said in the beginning, this is not a topic that, you know, where what I say in this discussion should be taken as psak. It's just not. I'm just trying to provide people with material, and they should go to their halachic authorities for actual, you know, practical application of it. Okay, I ran through that last portion, obviously, to fit it in. It's 11. Please note, anybody who's leaving who hasn't yet signed in the chat, please make sure you sign in the chat. It is heartbreaking to email somebody afterwards and say, I know you signed up for a credit thing, but you didn't sign in, and therefore we can't send you a letter. If you sat here for an hour and a half, sign in, please. That's number one. Number two is I'm going to stay on for questions and comments. Someone wrote in the chat, the College of Physicians and Surgeons of Ontario says I should not bring in my own religious and personal views when treating patients. So, that's something we've discussed on other occasions. We've talked about this problem of how to navigate that with patients. And we've talked about the issue of lifnei iver, and am I putting a stumbling block in front of the blind if they're going to go to somebody else and get the same advice, and what the methods are for dealing with it. It's a little bit beyond the scope of the discussion right now. But I acknowledge that this is very much a challenge, and especially if you're dealing with a patient who has halachic concerns, but you're not supposed to be bringing them into the conversation. Although I guess that's less of a concern because then they know and you know and you're able to arrange a conversation. I guess it's harder when it's actually somebody who isn't sensitive to it and now you feel like I'm giving them advice that's halachically bad advice. So yes, I agree that that's a challenge. Which, you know, I'll go back to the discussion that the Tzitz Eliezer has. I always go back to this discussion about the anesthesiologist who is asked to provide supportive services for an abortion that is not halachically acceptable. So they say, well, I'm helping them to do something that I know is halachically prohibited. And the Tzitz Eliezer basically comes out saying this is acceptable, that it can be done, for a variety of reasons ranging from the fact that they didn't ask this person. This person is providing supporting services. They're not actually doing the abortion. They're not going to have to lose their livelihood. There's no obligation of rebuke. I would tend to apply that in circumstances where you're counseling a patient on something like this and saying straightforwardly, I am in this position giving you medical advice. I'm not giving you advice from a Jewish law perspective. That's not what I'm, that's not my position here. And then they can choose to pursue it as they wish. So that may be a reasonable option to offer. Okay, other questions and comments?